We made this.
It's not easy to do what you did. You made my man look like a bunch of minimum wage mall cops. That's hurtful. Would you like to tell me where you received your training? Afghanistan? Chechnya? Who are you?
I have sacrificed much to achieve peace. For through your arrogance and stupidity, you have opened these peaceful realms and innocent lives to the horror and devastation of war.
You are a vain, greedy, cruel boy.
You are an old man and a fool!
You're unworthy!
Father.
I now take from you your power! I cast you out!
Please, open your eyes.
Oh, no, this is Earth, isn't it?
Where did it come from?
Your ancestors called it magic. And you call it science. I come from a place where they're one and the same.
Disobeyed his king. His fate is in his own hands now.
I will end this.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Podcast 616, the Marvel podcast geekier than the first two rows of San Diego Comic-Con. I am your host Hugh McStay, and over the next few weeks Podcast 616 is going to be doing a deep dive into Marvel Studios' Thor franchise as a lead-in to Taika Waititi's upcoming Thor Love and Thunder. Joining me this week to indulge in a little retrospective of Marvel Studios' 2011 film Thor is writer and podcaster Craig McKenzie. Hi Craig, how you doing?
Hello, I'm doing good. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, not bad. I had a lot of fun with this film again. It's the first time I've watched it in a couple of years, so I'm excited to kind of to chat about it and see what you think. It should be noted, we will be discussing this film with full spoilers, so anyone listening to this before they've seen the film, which I can't imagine can be anyone in the world at this point, right? I should pause and come back later.
Spoilers for a, what, 10-year-old film at this point?
yeah. Well, do you know, people get very antsy when you jump straight into spoilers without giving them a heads up, regardless of how long it is. It's really weird. So, they can't say that we've not done our due diligence on this one. Before we actually get into the film, can you tell me a wee bit about your levels of interest in Thor generally? Like, were you a big fan of the character growing up? Were you excited about this film's release at the time?
I was really excited about the MCU in general because this was very much in the beginning times of the, oh, this is all connected, this is really exciting, we're going to get the Avengers eventually. This is a pre-Avengers hype level, so Iron Man, you get Nick Fury turn up if you hang around till after the credits. I imagine a lot of people didn't notice that until the such times that happened. The Hulk, you get Tony Stark showing up, which was incredible to think of at the time. And then Iron Man 2, you get the tease of this film, plus Nick Fury again. And then this film comes out and, well, this is not quite so building up to the Avengers as such. Well, it is in a way because you know that Loki becomes important, but you don't know that when you're watching the film. So, yeah, I was hyped to see how it was all going to link together. The Thor comics, I read a lot of them growing up, and they're pretty ridiculous. And his affiliation with the Avengers as well. You had the Donald Blake, I guess he was possessing Donald Blake, I think that's the best way to put it, and taps his cane 3 times and he becomes Thor, and you had all the stupidity of him lying to Jane Foster, who was his nurse, and stuff like, okay, Jane, just you go out and sit in reception and I'll call Thor, so you come in 5 minutes and I won't be here, but Thor will be. Just don't worry about it. It's exactly what we're thinking of. But yeah, the notion of Thor having a secret identity, I suppose it didn't seem stupid in the 60s, but it kind of seems stupid now.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's an odd one. I mean, Marvel, obviously, in those early days, it just felt like everyone had to have a secret identity regardless, didn't it? That was kind of the one of the staples of their storytelling. You know, you could do stories around that, kind of the danger of that being revealed to the world. So, yeah, if you felt like it, everyone had to have one. And it's interesting that the MCU actually go the opposite way as much as they possibly can. You know, they go out of their way to ensure that no one has a secret identity. And the only character, I suppose, that has got one that they've used as a massive plot point has been Peter Parker with the Spider-Man films.
Yeah, and possibly Kamala Khan on Ms. Marvel. We don't know yet.
Oh, yeah, you'll see how that develops.
Yeah, but even she tells her best friend immediately. So,
well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I mean, Marvel are more interested in sort of portraying these heroes as sort of celebrities as much as anything else. You know, it's like you've got people who, like Kamala Khan, who are attending Avengers Con, you know, because they're so excited by the things they've seen on TV. And obviously, there's that wonderful scene in Endgame where the kids are, you know, got up to Hulk to get his autograph.
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually quite like what the MCU do with that idea. Although I think they've made the right choice with Spider-Man, because it's such a huge part of that character that he's got a bit of a crummy life, to be honest. And, you know, the secret identity has to be part of that, definitely.
And even then, they don't play too much with it, as in when he interacts with other heroes. Well, maybe not from now, but when he interacts with other heroes in the MCU, they all know who he is. He just doesn't wear his mask when he's around Avengers and so on. It's more of the at school thing, but even then, they don't do too much with it, because everyone close to him already knows. And then the third film is about, yeah, everybody knows now, so what do we do?
So, I mean, for me, with Thor, I'll be honest, I didn't really read many of the Thor comics growing up. I was a Marvel kid. I read a lot of different comics, so he would always be one of those characters who would appear in comics that I'd read rather than be like the actual main protagonist or hero. So I don't have a huge background. Most of the stuff I know about Thor comes from the Ultimate Run of comics, when Marvel did their big Ultimate re-release in the 2000s. And I'm a big fan of the Ultimate comics. I think it loses its weight points, but there's some terrific stuff in there.
I like Ultimate Spider-Man, but I don't like most of the other Ultimate stuff. It kind of feels like I don't know if it predates The Boys, but I feel like they're just trying to do Marvel by way of The Boys. As in, let's try and make it edgy, and I don't think it works.
I think it does get like that, but I mean, I don't know. I think there's some really interesting stuff. I like Ultimate X-Men. I think that's a great run. And what they do with Ultimate Reed Richards, I think, is absolutely tremendous. I'd like to see a version of that at some point in the MCU, but that's getting slightly off topic. So let's have a look at the film itself in question, Thor. So before Marvel Studios became what it is, back in 1991, apparently Sam Raimi had been attached to develop Thor with Stan Lee. Stan Lee said that he pitched it to Fox and they just didn't understand it, to what they were trying to do. And you can imagine, I mean, how would this film look under the auspices of Sam Raimi in 1991? That'd be a really interesting project to see. So, I mean, after that, I think throughout the last 20 years before it actually came to fruition, there was different people attached to it. I think most notably Matthew Vaughn tried to bring it to the big screen in 2007. But it just never went anywhere. I think there were budgetary issues, and then obviously the contract he was involved with at Fox, where he was let go from that sort of holding deal, so he went off to do other things, and eventually would do, I think, the X-Men First Class is what he went on to there. So again, it feels like one of those projects that like has garnered a lot of interest over the years, but never actually managed to, you know, get over the finishing line. And then obviously the famous story of Marvel taking out that massive loan to cover the cost of the production of their first few films. They decided that Thor would be part of that initial run.
Who have we still got the rights to?
So I think it was, I mean, the initial, like, they conceived it, I think, of as the original Avengers, didn't they? It was going to be Thor, obviously the Incredible Hulk, which was produced by Universal, the Iron Man films and Captain America, but I think people forget how big a risk it was at the time. I mean, because that loan could have bankrupted Marvel if those films weren't successful. And I mean, I don't know what you think. I mean, of the characters selected, Thor certainly feels like the riskiest character.
He does, but we'll talk about it. I think they do a lot of things to mitigate that potential risk, because this version of Thor isn't as weird as the comic book version.
No, absolutely, yeah. When I was doing the research for this, when I was reading, I was interested at how the parallels with something like Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, in terms of it's a project that's quite different to everything else that they kind of had on their slate. And it just felt like a big gamble. Obviously, by the time Guardians came around, they'd already established themselves as this behemoth that couldn't be moved.
Yeah, we did the Avengers. We can do anything. We'll give this a go.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Kenneth Branagh was hired ultimately to direct the film, which I remember at the time feeling like a really odd choice, you know, for someone with Branagh's back catalogue and sort of Shakespearean history to be doing a film like a Marvel movie. But then, I suppose, you know, the sort of Shakespearean element of the Thor character lends itself quite well to his style.
Yeah, it does, if they were doing that, but I don't think this film necessarily does that.
Again, we'll get to that. I do think there are elements of that that still exist throughout the film, and it'd be interesting to kind of get your thoughts on that as we get to it. And the score is put together by Patrick Doyle. I do like the score in this film. He's one of these guys who has been around forever. He works with Branagh on pretty much everything from Henry V right through to this. You know, I think he did some really great work on Frankenstein as well. It was all set up really interestingly. There was people attached to the film who, like I said, you wouldn't necessarily assume would be the right fit, but somehow it seems to work. So what are your general thoughts on the film, Craig?
So Thor is at the bottom of the pile of the MCU films for me. It's not my favourite one. So it's interesting that I was supposed to do this podcast because it's a film I don't rate. And there were some sort of scheduling issues. The reason was I was supposed to be on with a Thor super fan originally, and then it didn't happen. So I'm still here talking about it, even though it's not my favourite film. It's, you know, I don't have a kind of passionate hatred for it. I just think it's not one that I care to revisit very often. But the weird thing is I do like the characters. I think Chris Hemsworth's really good in the role. You know, it's a strange bit of casting, really, Hemsworth, when he was first cast, because I remember I saw him in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek film, and I was like, him? He's not. And then you see his sort of workout routine after the first pictures start to emerge, and you're like, oh, my God.
And then they make the weird choice, Orion, as well, to cover up his arms for half the film. What are they doing?
Yeah. It's not one of my favourite movies of the MCU.
Well, that's all right. That's okay. It's all about differing opinions. For me, again, I wouldn't say it's not like in my top 10 of what the MCU is, but I'm trying to kind of put myself in that headspace of what I thought about it when I first went to the cinema to see it. You know, when those sort of, oh God, the halcyon days of 2011 when the world was a very different place, you know. And I really, I remember when I came out to the cinema just thinking, like, it was so sort of bright and vibrant, and, you know, obviously deciding to do the film as a fish out of water story, kind of hitting up against the sort of the grandiose stuff that's going on in Asgard, I think it's really interesting, actually. It feels something like two films playing off against each other. And I actually think, if I'm honest, both sections of the film work really well. I think there's a real sort of, as I say, a vibrancy about the stuff on Asgard, and I think Asgard looks terrific. I mean, it's a bit CG heavy, of course, because that's what you're going to get.
Yeah.
But there's a real tactile feel about it, because, I mean, this was before Marvel went down the road where everything was CGI, everything's green screen. And, like, you know, there have been sets built, there are actors acting on sets, it's great. And that's when I think it's at its strongest, because Branagh really gets to kind of exercise those directorial muscles that he would use in the stage. And obviously his history of working with guys like Tom Hiddleston stand him in good stead. And I think he gets great performances out of pretty much all of the cast. Again, we'll come to that. I mean, what do you think of Asgard? Let's start there. Let's have a chat about that. What do you think of the depiction of Asgard in the film?
The Asgard stuff's my favourite part of this. This is what I really enjoyed. And I remember having a bit of not quite an issue, but I remember having a bit of confusion over the approach when I first saw this film, because my experience of Thor in the comics is he is a magical, godly being, whereas in this, it's just an alien. And all this stuff that we've associated with the Norse mythology is just technology that was misinterpreted by primitive people of the time. So the Bifrost is a wormhole generator and things like that. So there's, I don't know, a bit of a disconnect there for me, I guess. It's something that I've gotten over since then, and it didn't, I suppose it did colour my opinion of the film, but it wasn't a deal breaker for me. It was just something that took me a minute to adjust to. But I think their aliens versus their gods thing is a bit confused within the films as well, because they talk and behave as if they're gods on another plane of existence, and then they're just using machines and stuff. So there's a strange, as I say, disconnect between those two things. It's almost like there was a version of the script, or they were writing the script with the whole their magical beings in mind, and then they were told to change it, and then it didn't translate to the way that Asgard works. So you still have things like Odin has to do the Odin sleep, which they don't explain what it really is or why it's relevant or why that weakens them. There's a lot of stuff that just happens and they don't tell you what the significance of it is. It's that, well, he's in the Odin sleep, but he might never wake up.
I wonder if the decision to kind of reframe the Asgardians as just an advanced race rather than sort of godly beings is kind of back to that thing I was talking about at the start about the risk involved in this film.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Yeah, I think there's maybe a worry that, you know, you go from this guy who's very intelligent building, you know, an armor suit that can fight bad guys, and you go, oh, that's quite interesting. And then, of course, you've got the Incredible Hulk, which is like science gone wrong, which, again, you can kind of, you can suspend your disbelief and enjoy the story.
Yeah, Jekyll and Hyde, we all know how that works.
Exactly. And then moving from that to, oh, yeah, there's also gods, and, you know, they've been around forever. I just think that's maybe too much of a tonal shift for early MCU. And I think it's fascinating to see how the MCU has kind of leaned into the sort of mystical stuff. And crikey, they've even introduced full-on gods with, you know, stuff like Moon Knight and maybe even the Eternals and Black Panther's ancestral plane, you know. So yeah. I think it's interesting when you revisit this film, knowing where the MCU is going to go with gods and then trying to fit the Asgardians into that sort of mythology. I think that's a little bit sweaty and a little bit difficult. What do you think?
Yeah, it is. Although now that they've started leaning into gods as beings that exist, there has to be some kind of tiering explanation now. You know, what is a god and what isn't a god? Do the Asgardians have gods? Because they do mention Valhalla in this film.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Is that where the Asgardians go when they die? Because in Moon Knight it establishes that, or almost establishes that, this whatever afterlife you believe in is the one you end up in, because it's multiple choice. You can go wherever you want. They all exist. So does Valhalla exist? Do we get to see Odin going to actual Valhalla? What is that? And yeah, so we need a bit of a chart, I guess, to see what the delineation between gods is. Because for Love and Thunder, the depictions of Olympus, they look a bit like Asgard in the way that's, yeah, so it's just a bunch of aliens that pass themselves off as the Greek gods. Were assumed to be the Greek gods, which makes you wonder where Athena from the Eternals fits in, because did she inspire Athena, or did she just copy the legend of Athena that already existed?
That's the thing that confuses me, is like, you know, they very much lean into the idea of, you know, these beings have been around for so long, and they've inspired our myths and legends, which, again, I think that's a really neat idea, and that's fine, but that's not what they choose to stick with as the films have evolved. You know, as you said, they very much go into, no, there are gods and here they are. So yeah, I mean, where does Thor and, like you said, Athena, where do they fit in this sort of pantheon? As much as I would like to think that Love and Thunder will be interested in exploring that, I don't think it will be. I think it's going to be very hand-wavy.
Or they'll joke about it, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Who are gods? Are you gods? I don't know, we're not gods. What's going on? Yeah, it'll be a bit like that.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I agree with that. So one of the things I really love about the scenes in Asgard is the designs for the characters. You know, like the armors and the weapon design and all that sort of stuff. I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, I honestly, with Loki's helmet, I mean, that's what has become one of those iconic things in the MCU. You know, the design of that helmet. But I mean, I just think it looks, the whole thing looks gorgeous before you get to the Earth scenes.
Yeah, that's where the Shakespearean side of it comes in, isn't it? It's all this ostentatious giant halls and flowery costumes and things like that. And the Thor's coronation ceremony that doesn't end up happening and then gets forgotten about at the end of the film. It's like, oh, we're not doing this anymore. Odin's had a rest and he's going to keep going. He's going to remain king of Asgard. So it almost sets up the arc of Thor getting used to the idea of being king, but yeah, he starts off being arrogant, and then he's in the hall and he's, you know, bouncing the hammer around and acting like a spoiled, entitled rich kid, which is how he starts, I suppose. But yeah, it looks great. The costuming, I don't think the dialogue is Thor-ish enough, though, because I'm used to the these and those and all that from the comics, the way that he talks, or at least he did early on, so I was kind of expecting some of that. Well, I do see it would be a barrier to entry, I suppose, but you could have, like, Odin talk like that, and Thor be like, this is stupid, I'm not talking like that. You know, this is how the old guys talk. That would have been a good thing.
The plot itself is very sort of, you know, Shakespearean, you know, the duplicitous brother trying to sabotage his, you know, his older, better brother's rise to the throne, betraying his father, all that sort of stuff. And I think the interactions between Hopkins, Hiddleston and Hemsworth while they're in Asgard, I think that's some of the film's strongest scenes. It's treated with a seriousness that's kind of missing from the rest of the film. And again, that's not a criticism. I think the humour works really well, which we'll get to as we go along. But it's also a seriousness that the MCU feels like it's missing sometimes, you know, where there is that constant need to undercut something serious. Not always, but, you know, often to cut something quite serious with a joke. Whereas Thor, at this early stage in proceedings, has the confidence of its conviction to play it completely straight. And I think that's why Hiddleston has kind of become such a huge part of the MCU, because his performance in the film, in those more serious scenes, are kind of what people latch on to.
Definitely, and he's the reason people are watching the Thor films in some ways. It's that, you know, Loki ran away with so much success after his Tom Hiddleston's depiction of him and his various appearances. Now he has his own TV show, which isn't this Loki. Or it is, but it isn't. You can see the genesis of all these things that people have latched onto in this film. And although I do think that Hemsworth's sort of struggling with his accent, he doesn't know what to do with it. He doesn't know how Thor should sound. It's, you know, am I doing an English accent, or is he going to be Australian? Or is it just these Australian comes through now and again? He doesn't seem to know how to speak. It's quite distracting in places, actually.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I like how that's developed, though, throughout the films. You know, well, now he still kind of has the Thor accent, but he's much more relaxed. And, you know, when the Australian brogue kicks through, it doesn't seem as out of character anymore, just because it feels like part of that accent that he's cultivated. You're right, yeah. It's really odd when you're listening to it in this film. And also, the other thing in this film that every time I watch it drives me mad is his blonde eyebrows, which I just... Who made that decision?
His like, bleached that, eyebrows, that is not, yeah.
Oh, it is dreadful. He looks so unusual, and like you almost can't see his eyebrows at points, so he looks permanently surprised, you know? You don't really know what's going on.
Even his beard is a bit oddly coloured, yeah, in this one as well.
Yeah, it looked like they were going for like super blonde everything, and yeah, it didn't quite work. Whereas in later films, he's still got the blonde hair, but they allow his facial hair to be kind of naturally coloured. It makes such a difference to the look of the character, yeah, which is really weird. So, I mean, in terms of, yeah, that's an interesting one. In terms of the look of Thor, you know, we're just talking there about the sort of, you know, the beard and that. But like, what do you think of the costume? Because, I mean, this is something that they would change quite quickly, I think, after the Avengers film.
It's basically his ultimate costume in this, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they do the nod to the helmet, as in he's wearing it for the ceremonial purpose, but he doesn't wear it again. Uh-huh. And I know that in Ragnarok he wears a version of the helmet, and then in Love and Thunder he's going to be wearing the helmet for at least one sequence. So I guess there's this reluctance to cover actors' faces in these films, which is unfortunate when so many of these characters are wearing full body suits. So, yeah, Spider-Man, as we've already talked about, he's taking his mask off to have a chat every time, because otherwise you don't see Tom Holland. And then Tony Stark, we've got the inside of armour helmet point of view that you always get. Or now he just has nanotech where he just takes the mask off. Well, not now because he's dead, but before he
spoilers,
died,
Craig, spoilers.
Spoilers for Endgame. But so that's what they would do there. And I guess with Thor, it's like, yeah, we can't cover Chris Hemsworth's handsome face with a helmet for the whole film. So we'll say it's a ceremonial thing. He wears it for, you know, parties and events and stuff, but he doesn't wear it as a matter of course. But yeah, his costume looks really good. The armoured sleeves, I'm not a fan of, really.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. And I think it's not until maybe, is it the second film where they kind of fix that, they remove that? Because I think he still has it in the Avengers film.
He has it and doesn't in the Avengers film, depending on the scene. It's when he's ready to go into the Battle of New York, where he summons the sleeve somehow.
That's right.
Before that, I don't think he has it at all. I think he's just fighting, you know, bare-armed.
That feels like a good move from He Who Shall Not Be Named directing that film. It was... Yeah, I mean, the only other thing in the costume that I'm kind of glad that they've amended was the cape. It looks a bit too sort of big 80s shoulders for me. It looks unwieldy and a bit odd. But
yeah
the costume itself is pretty good. Same with Loki. We touched on that earlier. The design of Loki's costume is brilliant. I love the helmet. It's so cool, and it helps to add that little bit of recognisability to the character, you know, immediately with those horns. So I really enjoyed that. When the film moves to Earth and we get those Earth scenes, so I was reading that they'd filmed it on site, in Galisteo, New Mexico, which is the Kero Pelon Ranch. Now, this apparently is a really famous place that's kind of hosted loads of films over the years. So I think it's like Young Guns 2, Wyatt Earp, even the magnificent Walker, Texas Ranger has filmed there. So, but I love that they were on set somewhere or that they were on location somewhere. And again, I really do think it makes a difference to the feel of the film. I felt similarly about Chloe Zhao's Eternals, whilst that film has many, many problems, and you know, it's certainly something I could discuss at length. It looks gorgeous, it looks great, and there's a different feel to it because you feel that the actors are where they're meant to be. What do you think of that idea of actually filming where you're meant to be rather than just on a green screen?
Yeah, I don't think it bothers me as much as it bothers some other people. I know a lot of people attack Marvel for that approach, the inside a studio, you know, either green screen, or now I think they use the Mandalorian flood tech.
Yeah.
Or at least they have been doing it. They've been experimenting with that because it's almost like you're there, but you're not really there sort of thing. You're reacting to an environment that's projected, but it's not. You're still not there. And it doesn't bother me as much as it bothers other people. I do think it is better when they're actually on set because then you see the little random flourishes that you can only get by actually being outside, the wind blowing your hair or whatever, that, you know, or like you're sweating because it's hot. And it's not studio like sweating, it's that permanent, we're in New Mexico and it's just unpleasant the whole time, sort of hot. You know, you can tell that they're there, and you can usually tell when they're not there. But if the story's good, doesn't bother me. And I do understand the restrictions that come with the location shooting, the unpredictability, all that stuff. And I think that Kevin Feige just doesn't like that. He just wants the film to be made and, you know, on schedule and whatever else. And then you have to factor in the pandemic as well. You know, the fact that they got anything made during that was remarkable. So, yeah, I think Marvel are going back to this as well. They're stopping the, you know, the artificiality of it, because I think people are starting to get a little bit sick of it. So with things like Eternals, they're going back to it. Moon Knight, they built sets for the Egyptian stuff, etc. So I think upcoming films will be much more like that. I think Love and Thunder will probably be a big green screen extravaganza because I suppose it kind of has to be. But again, it doesn't really bother me, especially when the stuff looks as good as it does. I think creating these worlds in a controlled environment is great. But yeah, if you're filming in New Mexico, film in New Mexico. Just go there because it exists. We know that it exists. Or film somewhere that looks like it, at the very least. There is that authenticity to it.
I think I fall in the same camp as you, where it's not something that like bothers me a lot. I think it's just when I revisit a film, or when I see something that isn't shot on green screen, you kind of go, ah, right, okay, yeah, I do understand the differences, and you know, I get where people are coming from. Similarly, I think some things you really can't tell that it's on green screen if it's done well. You know, it's like you said, with the tech that they've kind of perfected with use on The Mandalorian, it's making things like this much easier to do, and it's making it much easier to kind of like fool people to believe that they're actually there. So, yeah, it's not a huge issue. But I just, like I said, there's a different feel to the scenes when you know that, you know, that, you know, they're not standing on a stage, they are outdoors, they are wherever they're meant to be. So, yeah, it's interesting that Marvel are kind of pushing, are going back to that sort of model. Not for everything, obviously, because that would cost an obscene amount of money. But yeah, it's certainly something that I think they should be looking to do. So yeah, in terms of those Earth-based segments, which make up, you know, pretty much half the film, so Thor is cast out of Asgard because he tries to start a war again in Jotunheim by going up against Laufey, who I had no idea until this watch through was Colm Fury. I had no idea that was who that was.
Yeah, he's pretty well hidden under makeup, isn't he? Or CGI, or a combination thereof, I'm not sure.
Because he's not in it very much, I don't think I ever really paid much attention to it. And this time, obviously, doing a little bit more digging, I was quite surprised. Actually, do you know, just, I know we're jumping around a little bit, just while we're talking about Jotunheim, what do you think of the Frost Giants in general as sort of antagonists, and Laufey in particular?
I thought they were quite disappointing, but when I hear the word Frost Giants, I don't expect 8 feet tall. I expect 40 feet tall or whatever. And again, in the comics, that's what they are. They're giants in the way that you would assume. And so you get to Jotunheim, and then there's Oh, look, here's the Frost Giants. They don't look that big. Yeah. Which is a bit disappointing. So on that score, I do think they could have... There's no reason they couldn't have been actual giants either, because they don't have any direct interaction with the other characters in ways that need them to be of a similar height.
Mm.
There are means to an end, really. As in, it's just, okay, they broke into Asgard, so Thor gets told, don't go there, because we want to keep the peace. And Thor's like, well, I'll go there anyway. And then he goes and then he fights a bit, and then that's what leads to him getting chucked out. And then after that, it's, we're going to destroy Jotunheim for some reason. And that's about it. So there's very little to them, I think.
The decision to go to Jotunheim is actually one of my favourite moments in the film. It's very funny when Hiddleston's Loki manipulates Thor into going. His delivery of the line, like, oh, no, brother, we mustn't go to Jotunheim. It makes me laugh every time. It's like, no, oh, Thor, don't do that. That's a terrible idea. It's fantastic. He's so wormy and weaselly, and it's brilliant. This is coming across a huge Tom Hiddleston fan in general, but I think his Loki is one of the MCU's highlights. Whatever your mileage might be on the TV show that they released, I know it's a bit divisive. I think as a character throughout the films, he's always great value, no matter what he's doing or how big the role is or what his part is in it. So we end up on Earth. Thor has to be suitably chastened, and that's where he runs into our human band of characters who kind of take us through the next little portion of the film. So again, let's just talk generally about those characters, and then we'll get into the performances as we go. So obviously Natalie Portman's Jane. What do you think first of all, the casting of Natalie Portman, who I think at the time was kind of, you know, she still is a big star, obviously, but at the time, I think this was around, was it around the Black Swan time?
Black Swan was after this, I think. But
she was kind of rising again in prominence. Obviously, she'd done the prequel trilogy of Star Wars. And what do you think of Natalie Portman in the film?
I think she's fine, but I think she'd be the first to say that she didn't really get much out of doing these films, because she's the character's girlfriend again. It's that holdover from the, you know, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man era of Marvel or comic book movies, where it's, you've got the hero, you've got their love interest, you have the villain. It's the, you know, the formula, I suppose, that they're still riffing on before the MCU figures itself out. So she's just kind of there to enable Thor to do stuff. And then she has a bit of her own thing in there. She has her... She clearly has a lot of personality, a lot of confidence, a lot of sass and whatever, but she doesn't have a terrible amount to do. And part of what I don't like about the Earth stuff is I feel like everything happens too quickly. So the whole idea is Odin sends Thor to Earth so he learns humility, which he does over a weekend, and then he comes back and he's slightly more humble than he was before. And I don't buy into the romance. They get together because she's a love interest in a superhero film, and that's what they do. It's not organic in any way, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's admirable that they try and make the character important. You know, they make her effectively as an astrophysicist, you know, and she's looking at these things, super hyper intelligent, all that sort of stuff is admirable. But then when it comes to actually using her in the film, it's just a bit disappointing, you know, because you've got an actress of the caliber of Natalie Portman. And I think, and again, I know this isn't the common consensus, but I actually think her chemistry with Chris Hemsworth is terrific. The problem is the way they shoehorn the entire story into a weekend, as you said. You know, it's hard to believe that they've fallen madly in love with each other when they've only interacted, like, maybe, what, like six times?
Yeah. I think their chemistry is actually pretty good, but I don't get romance vibes from it. Like, chemistry doesn't have to always lead to romance. They could just be really good friends. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, I genuinely think that she's good in what she's asked to do. The problem is she isn't really asked to do enough.
Yeah.
And whilst I think the MCU has got better at it, in fact, even early MCU films make an effort. Like, I think the Peggy Carter character in Captain America, the First Avenger, is terrific. You know, she's given so much agency and she's doing her own thing and really strong character.
Even Pepper as well. She's done better than this.
Exactly. 100%. Yeah, 100%. But Marvel do have a blind spot from time to time. You only have to look at the best example I can think of would be Doctor Strange. And, you know, Christine Palmer, who is just, again, you hire such a talented actress and then you sideline her with a role that is nothing more than love interest.
Yeah.
You know, it's disappointing. But again, I do think that Marvel are learning from that. And I kind of hope that going forward that they continue to go their own way and do something different, which I think they will do. And I think obviously we know that Jane will be returning in Love and Thunder, and I kind of hope that they're going to take that opportunity to completely reframe that character and, you know, fix the issues that they made along the way. Because whilst I think she's fine in this, I think, because I think Natalie Portman, it's very difficult for Natalie Portman not to be fine in most things. She's a very good actress. The problem is, you know, when you get to Thor the Dark World, she's already kind of checked out. I mean, her performance in Thor the Dark World is famously like disinterested to the point of comatose, you know. You almost feel that she's gone for an Odin sleep happy through that film, because she goes, there's so little going on. And I don't blame her, because that film does almost nothing with her. What it does is it paints her as the sort of damsel in distress, and then the rest of the film is really Thor trying to save her, which is just, you know...
Although I do think she has some interesting stuff to do in the second film. She's the one that puzzles out the convergence, although she doesn't know what it is at the time. So there's that. And then the way that she's figuring out how the Asgardian technology works as well. I mean, it's a one scene and it's one beat, but I do think she has a little bit more to do in the second film. But yeah, it's still not enough. So yeah, Love of Thunder has to fix it, I suppose.
When they announced that she was kind of that she was gone from the MCU and she wasn't returning, I couldn't really blame her too much. because like I said, the character just, it didn't feel like it was going anywhere. And yeah, no, I was excited when I heard she was coming back, because again, she's a really good actress, and I think the MCU's like it's my favourite sort of genre of film at the moment, my favourite sort of franchise. I look forward to them coming out, watch all the TV shows, absolutely eat everything up I can get a hold of. So yeah, the idea of an actress of that calibre returning and kind of being given more to do and given a role that she's obviously excited about doing, because I've got to imagine, as well as a truckload of cash driven up to her front door, you know, there's no way you would get her back if you hadn't really got her excited by the script. So that's one of the things that I'm most looking forward to Love and Thunder for.
I can just imagine Taika Waititi phoning her and saying, do you want to be in the next Thor film? She's like, no, I'm had enough of that, I'm not doing that. And then he's like, you can be Thor though, you can do that this time. And she's like, oh yeah, okay. Then she hits the gym and then you see the results of that.
Oh, she looks terrific in the trailer. Yeah, she looks absolutely brilliant.
There was pictures released of her like post-workout as well. And it's, oh my God, you're huge. Like, frighteningly huge.
Oh, I've not seen them. I need to go to a deep dive Google later and have a look at that. Do you know, there's a missing Jane Foster performance that I would love to see. My daughter and I talk about this quite a lot. When at the end of Endgame, obviously Cap has to return all of the Infinity Stones to whence they came.
Yeah.
So there's surely a segment where Captain America's having to chase poor Jane down a corridor, trying to stab her again with the ether. So that, I hope that's touched on as we go back to it, but I don't know if it will be. But that there's definitely a missing shot.
That thing in Endgame always makes me laugh. It's the whole point in Love and Dark World is we don't know how to get this out of her, and then Rocket just stabs her with some device that he threw together, and it's in the back room on the on the Milano.
Hey, come on, Rocket's very smart. Tony helping him with that. Come on, you know, it's not at all a narrative blind spot. Except of course, it's definitely a narrative blind spot. So with Jane Foster, we also find the absolutely brilliant Kat Dennings as Darcy. What do you think of her in this film?
I think she's very annoying in this film.
No, I'm not having a word said against Kat Dennings, I'm sorry.
I like Kat Dennings, and actually the Darcy character is someone that I ended up liking a lot more as she appears later on. So her in WandaVision is the right level, because she still has that personality, but it's not quite as in your face. And I think... Well, she's the comic relief in this film, really. Well, there's a lot of comic relief absolutely. In this film, but she's the Earth comic relief, I suppose. So she's there to just, laugh at, make jokes. The, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. have stolen all our tech, and she's like, they took my iPod, and I just put like 40 songs on there because Kenneth Branagh has just heard what an iPod is, and that's what he assumes people do with it. And what does she really do in the film? I suppose it's the whole idea is she's only there for to complete some college credits. She doesn't have any skin in the game, really. She just gets caught up in this whole situation. So what's it, she's a political science major or something?
Yes. Oh, it makes no sense at all, absolutely. She should have been gone at the very first instance of trouble, you know, and she sticks out to the end. But again, I don't know if you could tell that my biases were showing slightly there, Craig. You know, I'm normally very impartial, but yeah, that one kind of slipped out. I think she's terrific in it, and in all seriousness, yeah, you're right.
I've not seen Kat Dennings in a whole lot, actually. I've seen some of Two Broke Girls, but I had to stop watching it because it's unbearable.
Yeah, it's not the best. It's not the best, but she is very good in it. You know, she delivers that sort of... she's got a particular brand of delivery, which I think works really well in the MCU. And you're right, I think she's used much better as it goes on, especially in WandaVision. I think she's very good in Thor the Dark World as well. Again, one of the few bright sparks in Thor the Dark World.
Where the comedy sidekick somehow has a comedy sidekick. That's a weird choice.
Again, I am all in for that. And the recurring Mew Mew joke just makes me laugh every time. It's funny. Apparently, I was reading that, Mjolnir is ancient Norse for grinder. But we still have no confirmation on what Mew Mew is ancient Norse for, which is quite disappointing, to be honest. I'm a fan of Kat Dennings. And again, I'm going to cut you off there, Craig, because I won't have another bad one. Stellan Skarsgård. I love Stellan Skarsgård generally. He's just a brilliant actor who I think he improves anything he's in. You know, it's like he's one of those actors that's like when he shows up, it's kind of like, oh, it brings a smile to your face because it's like, oh, wait, okay. So we're in a reasonable film here because we've got this guy on. And he's a character that he's great in this, and obviously he gets a surprising amount of use over the next few films, which I didn't anticipate. I don't know if he anticipated it when he signed up. But I think the last time we saw him was when he was taking Thor to like a spooky dream cave in Age of Ultron.
Yeah, he's not been seen since, yeah.
Yeah, I would really like to see him back, but especially, you know, in the aftermath of the blip and all these things, it'd be interesting to catch up with him. What do you think of Selvig?
They'll dig him up at some point, surely. He will reappear at some stage. I don't know where, but maybe in the next Thor film, maybe he'll be there, we don't know. If Jane's there, then there's a good chance he'll be there because of their relationship. And
that's a good point, yeah.
I really like him, this character, the Selvig character, and I do like the way that he's used throughout in the Avengers, the way he's used and so on, even though he's kind of possessed, but he's used well. And this is really good. He's almost like the Odin, but on Earth. You know, he's this wisdom and voice of reason and whatever. And I like the scene he has with Hemsworth where they both get drunk and he's like, I'm going to buy you another beer and then you're going to leave town. Do you understand that? Like, really protective, fatherly quality. You don't get a sense of, or you don't get the detail of their connection and you don't know what Jane's family life is like, but you maybe get the sense that she doesn't have a great familial relationship. And he's filling that gap. He's taking her on. I think he mentioned something about always looking out for her, whatever. I can't remember the exact dialogue, even though I watched it recently. But he does say something about, feeling responsible for her or something like that.
He's a really sort of reassuring presence in the film, you know. And there's a lot of, he speaks with such authority, you know, when Stellan Skarsgård's telling you something, no matter how ridiculous it sounds, you kind of go, you nod your head and go, he's right, that's interesting. So he gets away with, like, you know, talking about these ridiculous things. And I always find that as it goes further on, he's in Avengers, and when he's having to deal with these, like, ridiculous lines of dialogue about, you know, what's happening, he does it with such an authority, you kind of, you do go, that works, that's fine, I'm happy with that. Even though it's all just gobbledygook and bobbins.
Well, he does that whole, this is ridiculous speech, doesn't he? Where he's talking about they're saying words like Thor and Bifrost and whatever else, and it's like these stories I read when I was a kid. And Jane says, but that's a precursor to science fact, the talking about the Isaac Asimov stuff, you know, the sufficiently advanced technology, etc. And he's like, no, this is ridiculous. And it is ridiculous, but it's also real in the context of this world. And the reference to the Norse mythology stuff actually is another thing that bugs me about this film, because he picks up the book of Norse mythology and you see all the pictures. It's the Rainbow Bridge, there's Thor, there's Loki, etc. But then you look at the history of these characters. So during this point, the point in history that they're talking about, Thor and Loki were children, because you see that at the start of the film.
Yes.
So where did all this come from? And also, what Thor has in this book, this random book, kids' book of Norse mythology that's in the local bookstore, is spoilers for what he's about to encounter with his brother Loki. And I know that Thor and Loki aren't actually siblings in real Norse mythology, but at the same time, it's like, no, Loki, he's the trickster. He's going to try and get one up on you and stuff like that. So how do they know about Thor when he was a kid? It was sort of Odin that was interacting with Earth, you would think.
Yeah, it is interesting, and it's kind of a blind spot of the film. And again, I think because it's so early in this MCU run that I remember at the time just not really paying any attention to it. You know, it's just kind of, as I said before, there's this sort of tendency for these things where they just hand wave it away and it's like, you know, sort of like rattling some keys over here. Like, here, look at the shiny thing over here. Don't pay attention to the boot. Look at this. Look what's happening here. And so you're happy to say, oh, fine, we'll move on. But you're right, as the MCU's become this big sort of, you know, multifaceted, intertwining, interlinked story, it's like when you revisit these things, it does bug you a little bit. You're like, well, that doesn't quite work. I've got a friend who, and it's his obviously complete headcanon, you know, his headcanon is that, you know, that these characters live within the cycle of Ragnarok, so, you know, they're constantly getting to the end of the cycle and dying and then being reborn and going through it all again, that sort of okay. stuff. So that's how he told me, he kind of levels it off in his head. And again, I don't think that works quite no. well either, but fair enough, whatever helps you sleep at night.
Yeah, that works if they're magical beings, which they are not.
Exactly. And I wonder if we're in for a... especially with the upcoming Love and Thunder, I wonder if we're in for a sort of a reappraisal of that, where they do kind of like, suddenly they just are magical beings now, do you know what I mean? Because of when we've established that Frigga as well has magical abilities, and that's not science, you know? I wonder if we're in for a sort of like a reframing of that first Thor film. Again, it'll be incredibly difficult, I think, and incredibly sweaty to kind of get it right. But I think they do need to do something to address it as it's going forward.
Yeah, well, some people do have magical abilities and some don't. So, yeah, Loki, they don't really explain how he does that stuff. They sort of explain Mjolnir. It was forged in the heart of a dying star. So, again, that's a science thing. And somehow that gives Thor his power. But then you find out in Ragnarok that the power's got nothing to do with the hammer. It's all him. So I guess Are they essentially mutants? You know, are they just born into this society and they get different powers depending on luck? I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows? It's something they don't bother explaining because it's almost like they're aliens, but they're also, yeah, just magical power stuff. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, but when Thor runs into Doctor Strange, he's very matter-of-fact about it. He's like, oh, I see the Earth has sorcerers.
Yeah.
And it's like, so, right, so magic exists on Asgard, but the way this film talks about it is like, no, it's none of it's magic, it's all just advanced tech, don't worry about
it. The whole point of Mjolnir is you have to be worthy in order to lift it, right? Which is an enchantment.
Yes,
isn't it? But you suppose you could write it off as some kind of program, I guess, that's applied to it. But it's definitely an enchantment. Mm. You even have the symbol on the hammer, which will later be, you could associate with Doctor Strange or Scarlet Witch, the runes almost, and the worthiness. And then you get a bit of a debate about that in Age of Ultron, where Stark says, whosoever has Thor's fingerprint is the literal translation, that kind of stuff. And I do remember when the Big Bang Theory was good, they were debating over the lifting Thor's hammer thing. So the Hulk can pick up Thor while he's holding the hammer. So by the transitive property, he is holding the hammer. But he isn't, because Thor is lifting the hammer and the Hulk is lifting him. So I think they do have some fun with the who can lift Mjolnir and who can't over the coming films after this, because in the comics it's just accepted that it's enchanted so only one guy can lift it, or only people that randomly end up being worthy, like Beta Ray Bill and so on, that he can randomly lift it for some reason. And whoever else.
The stuff with Mjolnir is, in this film, it's kind of, there's not really much to it, you're right. It's, you know, and again, we're back to sort of the hand-waving stuff, so, you know, don't pay too much attention to it. But I mean, establishing those rules in this film obviously will prove to be really important going forward about who can and can't lift the hammer. And, you know, it's like, I don't know when I'll ever get a chance to talk about this again, Chris, I'm going to bring it up. My favourite moment in the MCU by a distance is the moment when Cap lifts the hammer.
Cheering in the cinema when that happens.
Yeah, I've never experienced that in a cinema. Like, I mean, You know, much like myself, you're Scottish, Craig, you know, we can be a bit reserved when it comes to things like that in the cinema. You know, you very rarely get those outbreaks, but I do remember sitting in the cinema and, you know, when the camera pans back to reveal that he's holding it, there was a ripple of, like noise throughout the cinema that I'd never heard before.
I was at the midnight screening and it was...
Yeah, I realised I was making the noise as well. It was kind of a subconscious thing, like, oh! So yeah, it's lovely to see that they established that so early on in this film, and obviously it becomes like a running gag throughout, you know, especially in Avengers Age of Ultron, you know, that wonderful scene where they're all sitting at the party having a go at lifting it.
And Cap budges it, and Thor's like, oh God. And then it's like, oh, yeah, you didn't lift it. Fine, we're fine.
I love it so much because, again, that now gets wonderfully reframed. And I think it's on purpose. I mean, I think the Russos are smart enough that gets wonderfully reframed that you now know that, obviously, Steve decided not to lift it at that point because he didn't want to embarrass his friend, which is brilliant. And, again, further plays into how my ridiculous Steve Rogers man. Let's go off that subject quickly because, you know, I could be here all day talking about that.
And then you've got Vision just lifts it, but he lifts it in such an unceremonious way. Just it's so matter-of-fact. Yeah. And Thor's like, don't know what to do with this. And then they have that discussion at the end about if you put the hammer in an elevator, the elevator will still move, but the elevator's not worthy.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of stuff.
It's brilliant, yeah.
You can just imagine the Avengers hanging around the compound being like, can you put Mjolnir on this and we'll see if it works. We'll see if the robot can lift it. We'll see. the party scene is great because, yeah, that's what the Avengers do when they're drinking. They just... Yeah, let's get drunk and see if you can lift me on the air.
Look, there's a bit of me that feels that I could watch an entire Avengers film where there is no villain whatsoever or no...
Where they're just doing that.
Yeah,
I love it.
Let me just hang out with these characters for a couple of hours and I'll be quite happy, to be honest, yeah. So with regards to the remaining cast, let's just go through these quite quickly because there's not many of them left. But Idris Elba playing Heimdall, and I think this was just before Idris Elba became Idris Elba, yeah. If you take my meaning. And it feels like such a waste in hindsight because he's such a charismatic actor. And Heimdall, whilst he's fine, he doesn't really have anything to do, you know?
I think he stands out, though. And the weird distortion he puts in his voice is kind of retroactively, why did you bother with that? Because they don't do it after this, I don't think.
Yes.
But he has that kind of booming distortion on his voice, which I guess works in this. But I think the key moments he has in this are really good. That's the, you know, I'm honour bound to my king, but if I don't see it, then that kind of stuff's like complicated fellow, isn't he? He has his code of honour, but he knows how to get around it by himself. I think that really works. And yeah, again, he's another magical being because he can see the entire universe somehow.
Well, yeah, exactly. There's lots of little bits like that. And again, before we do a wrap up, I'll talk about some of the big issues I've got with the film. But yeah, no, I just feel that Elba is one of those actors who I wish was still on the board, who's still available for maybe a more high profile role. And I do wonder if maybe Kevin Feige wonders the same thing. It's like, oh shit, maybe we should have held off maybe a couple of years and got him for something else, because you can absolutely see Idris Elba as a sort of top tier Marvel actor. You know, he could be hang with any of the A-listers that we find in the franchise.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a little bit disappointing, but like you said, it's a fun character. He's well, what he gets to do, he does very well. I just don't feel that there's kind of enough for him. What do you think of Lady Sif and the Warriors 3?
I think Sif has been done dirty quite a lot over the MCU. Weirdly, her most significant contributions are in the two episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that she's in, which may or may not be canon. We don't know anymore in terms of...
Well, yeah, it's all very...
They do hop in universes and timelines in that show, so, yeah, at some point it was canon, but it isn't anymore because they've changed the timeline. And the snap doesn't happen in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It definitely doesn't. So there's that to consider. But never mind, this isn't an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast. But, yeah, she's done quite, as I say, dirty over these. And the thing about the Dark World is there's clearly a much longer cut where there was supposed to be a love triangle between Thor, Jane and Sif that just doesn't exist in the film. It kind of exists. You get that jealous glance from Sif at one point and they have a conversation that suggests maybe it could be something, and then it never comes up again. And in this, she's, again, not really anything. She shows up to fight the Destroyer at the end, and she appears throughout trying to convince Loki to let Thor back into Asgard. And that's about it. But I think Jamie Alexander does stand out. I think she's really good. And the Warriors 3, I think they have some kind of presence, especially the one where they just make fun of the fact that he's fat. They just keep doing that. And Volstagg, yeah. And you get the one that's replaced by Zachary Levi in the next one, and no one really notices.
Fandral, is that
right?
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, and then there's the other one.
the other one, yeah. But that's the problem, isn't it? It's like they're all sort of like... I actually think they're at their best when they're used as just comedy relief, you know, and that's a shame because Jamie Alexander is wonderful. And again, I think I agree with you. There's a bigger performance there from her that I would like to see, and Do you know what, with the way Marvel's expanding, I don't kind of rule out that we will see her again at some point, actually. I wouldn't be overly surprised if she'd see her show up somewhere down the line.
I think she's in Love and Thunder, isn't she?
Oh, is she? Oh, well, there we go. I didn't know that.
I think so. I might be making that up.
With the Warriors 3, they're just so disposable and interchangeable, and like when they replaced Fandral with Zachary Levi, to my shame, I didn't notice in the second film. It wasn't until maybe like my second or third watch, it's like, oh, well, that's not the same guy, because they leave no real impact except for their, you know, they do have one of my favourite moments in the film when they show up on Earth, you know, to see Thor. That is a genuinely like quite an amusing moment when they just all show up at the window, like they've wandered out of some sort of cosplay somewhere. I think that's really good.
And there's a deleted scene where they say something about the Renaissance cosplayers are in town or something like that. I can't remember the exact line, but there's a deleted scene. If you have the physical release, then you can watch it.
And then in terms of the cast, finally, just Anthony Hopkins and Rene Russo, look at them together. I think Hopkins is given a sort of, obviously he disappears for half the film, which is disappointing, but as I said earlier, all the scenes with him, Loki and Thor, I think are terrific, absolutely brilliant. When the scene where he casts Thor out of Asgard and down to Earth, I think is genuinely spectacular. I think he is terrific in it. You feel the anger and the energy coming from him. And with Rene Russo, it's almost exactly what we said about Jamie Alexander. What an amazing actress, but like just given very little to do. But I actually think that her strongest moment comes in Endgame when she gets like what 2 minutes of screen time. When she meets sort of future Thor, and she's wonderful, and you just think, oh, why couldn't we have had that in the first two films? I don't understand it. What do you think of them?
She has a decent amount to do in this second film as well. Actually, I think her the stuff she has with Jane in the second film is pretty good, and yeah, she's not very much in this film. She's just kind of there. Odin is more of the disapproving father presence and whatever, but then sort of accepts him by the end because he learns his lesson somehow, which is quite so... It's not quite so well done as it should be. But I do wonder what the MCU would look like if they'd kept with the original casting of Brian Blessed as Odin. That was who they cast originally, or were planning to cast originally. I don't know if it fell through or what have you, but yeah, Hopkins wasn't the first choice.
You've ruined my day here, Craig, because I never knew that before. That is the missing piece of the puzzle. My God, imagine Brian Blessed in the MCU. That would be spectacular.
Could do it still. There's someone else. Does he still act? I don't know. Or does he just try and climb Everest and almost kill himself? Is that what he does now?
I've not seen him in anything for a while, actually. That's a point. But yeah, let's get him in as another god so that Gore the God Butcher can work his way through eventually. I'd be up for that. And just in terms of a sort of like overview of the film, what issues do you have? What do you think that the film struggles with? Where's its problems?
I think the Earth stuff really lets it down, because the whole point is, well, you've got the fish out of water comedy aspect of it, which works in some places and works and doesn't work in other places. I like when he walks into the pet shop asking for a horse, those kind of jokes. The slamming the coffee mug down because that's what he does in Asgard when he wants another drink, and those kind of... Yeah, those little arrogant beats, and those are there throughout. He has the arrogance when he starts on Earth, but then when he loses it, I don't really buy into the turning point where he becomes less arrogant. I don't think they cover that really well.
I think you're right. It's just he kind of wakes up one morning and makes breakfast for everyone, and it's like, well, I've changed my ways now.
It's been a weekend. I've been alive for thousands of years, but I'll change over a weekend. So that's the way these things work.
I'm just looking at my notes, and like I remember about... But maybe halfway through the film, I'd just written down kind of next to Thor's name, he's a bit of a dick, isn't he? Like, and that's kind of his character trait up until the point where he isn't a bit of a dick.
Things I like are Coulson. I think he's done really well in this film. I think he comes across as a really smart and experienced agent. It's the bit where Selvig comes to rescue Thor from S.H.I.E.L.D. custody. And Coulson's like, let's let him go. Let's see how this plays out. Let's keep an eye on this situation. Because they... immediately notice that the idea is fake, but Coulson's like, no, let's have a look, let's see how this happens. And and when he's going to lift the hammer, Coulson like holds back on ordering it with fire because he's like, no, I want to see this. I'm really interested in what's going on here. And great Hawkeye cameo as well.
Well, I was just going to say, just on that scene, is that the weirdest introduction we've ever had to an Avenger?
Possibly, yeah. It's there for comic book fans. It's not there for if you don't know who he is.
I mean, I remember at the time, and with hindsight even more so, it's just like, what? Why is he there? And like that ridiculous scene where you're kind of watching when Barton's told to go up in the rig, and you kind of, you're watching over his shoulders, you don't see his face, and he puts his hands on the gun and then decides, no, actually, I'm going for the cross. I'm going for the bow and arrow. It's like, well, come on, you're always going for the bow and arrow. Don't give me that nonsense.
Yeah, as if there'd be a choice. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I actually love that assault on the weird shield compound.
It's a good sequence, yeah.
Shoddy, unnecessary white tunnels. There's a proper physicality about them that's missing from the rest of the film, which is obviously Thor fighting CGI monsters. But yeah, no, it's really good. And it also features one of my favourite background characters, who we refer to in this house only as that bastard Sitwell. every time he shows up, we can't help it. There's a sort of mummering around the room. So he's just kind of standing in the background a few times. So I really enjoyed that scene. I think it's really, really good.
Filmically, he's in this season. He's in a short as well, or maybe two shorts. And
that's right, yeah.
He shows up in the Avengers as well, and in Winter Soldier. But he's in a couple of episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as well.
One of the other things I wanted to raise, because I'm interested in your thoughts on this, because I also have issues with it, is the idea of the final scene with the Bifrost being destroyed, and it's painted as this sort of like apocalyptic. Oh my God, we're never going to get back to Earth. We're stranded forever. Oh, how can we possibly fix this? It could take decades before we get back to this. And then the next film, he's back on Earth, you know, it's fine. And then even the film after that, it's like, it's all right, it's fine now, we're just travelling from planet to planet. I mean, what do you think of that?
Yeah, we're stuck here for a few months until we build a new one. It doesn't seem like a big deal, because that's the part of it being technology that, you know, it's like the script has it as magic, but then they did a find and replace on the word. So it's, okay, we destroyed the thing that creates the Bifrost, this magical artifact that creates the Bifrost. There isn't another one, so we're stuck. We don't know what to do here. And then in the Avengers, they just throw in a quick line about dark energy that Odin had to conjure to send him. And then in Dark World, there's just a new Bifrost. It's fine.
Also, as it goes on, though, we discover that you've got ships apparently as well. Just jump in your ship and you can fly wherever you need to fly to. Because by the time you get to Ragnarok, I mean, that's how they get back to Asgard, isn't it? They just, we'll just pop through this wormhole, it's fine. And we'll be there in no time at all.
Yeah, this wormhole that's just underneath Asgard, apparently.
So, yeah, but again, this is nitpicking, because these are issues that wouldn't have existed at the time, because, you know, I suppose Branagh and the scriptwriters didn't quite know what was going to come next for the film.
Well, I do wonder if they were throwing in little seeds that they might pick up as threads in the Avengers, and then they didn't decide to, because at the end you have the, okay, hook up to the S.H.I.E.L.D. satellites, Jane and Selvig and so on are doing that, they're working with S.H.I.E.L.D. and the suggestion is, we're gonna work together and we're gonna open up our own wormhole that Thor can come through. And you could see that being away from it come back in the Avengers, and it'd be framed differently, as in Loki's causing trouble, so we will summon Thor to come and help us. So I do wonder if, because it wasn't as joined up as it needed to be, really, or ended up being, or the people assume it is, because even the post-credit scene in this has nothing to do with Loki's influence in the Avengers, because he's working, Selvig's working with S.H.I.E.L.D., but Loki's whispering on his shoulder, and then that's not what happens later on. So it just seems like, we'll throw in a few ideas, and we might pick them up later, and then they don't.
That scene in particular, the post-credit scene where, you know, after Loki's been vanquished and... that's another question I have, but we'll get to that in a moment. But that scene where you know, you see Loki in the mirror and he appears to be guiding Selvig or influencing him in some way, it makes no sense at all. And it makes even less sense when you realise that it was directed by Joss Whedon. So where did he think that fit into his film that he's making? I can understand if it's something Branagh had been asked to put in, you know, to show some continuity. But you've got the guy who's directing the next film insisting that exists, and then by the time you get to that film, you go, well, so that meant nothing then. It's all just
yeah, bobbins. Just doesn't matter.
And again, just quickly before we move on to wrap this up, in terms of when Loki falls from the Bifrost, I would love to know how he ends up with Thanos. Like, it feels that there's a big step missing there. We don't really get too much.
Yeah, he just falls into a wormhole and ends up somewhere. Yeah,
and again, it's not a huge issue, but again, it's the Marvel completist in me who just wants to know, like, well, that must have been a fascinating, like, meeting Loki and Thanos, and, you know, deciding to give Loki control of his armies to get his Infinity Stone. And yeah, it's the Marvel Completist. I mean, there's lots of interesting things that I'd like to dig out.
Well, I mean, of course, the staff wasn't originally one of the Infinity Stones, was it? That's something they changed later.
Well, exactly. It doesn't make much sense that Thanos would give Loki an Infinity Stone to go and get him an Infinity Stone.
It's a speculate to accumulate plan. It's he's got to spend money to make money type situation. I mean, for Thanos, it would be just much easier if he'd invaded at that point. I think he would have encountered less resistance. Yeah.
Well, exactly. He gave the Earth far too much time to develop its superhero roster. So it's, you know, it's on him. Let's be honest, it's on him at the end of the day.
I think the Destroyer in this film is really cool. I think that's a really cool design.
It kind of looks like crikey, what's that film? The Day of the Earth Stood Still. I get those kind of vibes off it. That's what it reminded me of a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, and just a big imposing thing. And I actually think the sequence where Thor gets his groove back, gets his powers back and destroys it is really cool as well. It's quite an exciting sequence. And even though I don't understand how he's suddenly worthy, and because they don't ever define what worthiness is, you know, what deems you worthy or not, because it can't be humility because, I suppose Cap is humble, but at the same time, you would suggest with Asgardian culture it would be some sort of worthy warrior type thing, you know.
Is the implication not that because he was willing to sacrifice his life to save them, you know, he could identify fight this thing with no powers, that that's what makes him worthy? But even then, it's kind of, I might be wrong in this reading, but even then, I would say that Thor, when he was, inverted commas, worthy, would have done that anyway. He would have, you know, he would have stood up for those people and tried to save them, so.
Yeah, you'd imagine so, yeah. I love it when Coulson turns up and Thor just calls him Son of Coal. I think that's a great little, yes, little detail.
Yes, that's brilliant. The scene you were just talking about where he gets his groove back, when he gets Mjolnir, is terrific. However, I have to point this out, it features one of my most sort of cringe-worthy, like, embarrassing MCU moments, maybe the worst actually, when Natalie Portman is forced to deliver the line "Oh my god" while he transforms into a god.
Yeah,
I swear, I'd forgotten quite how bad it was. In my head I remembered it was coming up, and then when I watched it the other night, I could feel myself sinking into the sofa like, oh god, please. Just what, why? And you know that Portman knows she can't fix it. There's nothing she can do with that line. There's no way to make it any better. So she just leans into the absurdity of it. But, oh.
It's kind of a dumb thing, yeah.
Yes, it makes my flesh crawls. Oh, no, guys, no.
I do like her delivery of, is this how you always look? And he's like, more or less. And she's like, it's a good look.
Yeah. So, yeah, like, let's bring this to a close then, Craig. I think we've hit pretty much all of the major beats. So what would you say is this film's legacy in the MCU? How do you think it stacks up within the current canon of Thor films as well as other MCU films? Because I think he's been in 7 films so far, and Love and Thunder will be his 8th, which is a pretty good going, you know, for a member of the Avengers.
Yeah, I wonder who's the longest serving now. Probably still Samuel L. Jackson, because of his plethora of tiny appearances.
Well, yeah, that's fair. In terms of your actual main roster Avengers, though, I think it's got to be him and Tony that are at the top now, because obviously Tony appeared in the Spider-Man film and one of the Cap films as well, so that maybe pushes him slightly over, I'm not sure.
Yeah, although do you count Hawkeye as 6 appearances or 1 appearance? That's the question.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I'll need to get my big book of Marvel research out.
Someone should make a spreadsheet. Not me, but someone.
Yeah. That sounds like far too much work. So what do you think of the legacy of this film and Thor's place in it and how it stacks up with his future appearances?
I think it does have a significant legacy. As we've talked about, you've got the worthiness thing that feeds throughout, and it's still going to be a thing. You have to assume that Jane will do something or be revealed to be worthy in some way, unless the tattered shards of the hammer no longer have the enchantment attached to it. I don't know, but we'll find out. But yeah, the legacy is significant, although I do think the way that the Asgardians and Thor and so on, it changes a lot over the course of the MCU, and something in Ragnarok you get is the paradise, quote-unquote, that Asgard is supposed to be is this veneer that hides this really dark past. You've got that reference to colonialism where it's, oh yeah, Odin went through the 9 realms and he took over. He absolutely just cemented himself as being the ruler of all these things, and then, again, like the British Empire, I guess, relinquished his influence over time. You have to imagine that's why the Bifrost exists. Got to keep an idea on our, got to keep an eye on all our kingdoms that we ransacked and took over. And even then, in the Dark World, Thor restoring order to the Nine Realms is a bit colonialist as well, as in the whole.
Yeah,
and there's a bit of disorder here. I'm going to go sort it out. It's like, but is it your place to do that? Are they only taking advantage of an opportunity that exists because the Bifrost was destroyed? We can take our place back now. We don't have to listen to these awful Asgardians. And I think it's something they never quite take to task in the way that they need to. Maybe they will in the next one. Maybe the whole thing about new Asgard is we're not going to be that because we only exist in one town in Norway and couldn't be that. But at the same time, it's this dark past that they have to get around. But yeah, you've got the legacy of the hammer, you've got the legacy of the gods, you've got everything. And even the way that Thor interacts with the other Avengers and stuff, like the Infinity Stones get their first real play in this without you really knowing it.
Yeah, I mean, because there's that moment where they wander through the Odin's vault, isn't there? There's lots of different things kind of kicking around in the background.
The Fate Gauntlet.
The Fate Gauntlet, yeah. Which I remember being very excited about at the time. Because, I'm a huge geek and, you know, I must have, like, trawled that film so many times looking for what's in the background and see what it looks like and what's there. Because obviously I think there's not like four or five different things? Because I think the Eternal Flame shows up there as well for the first time, which I quite like. It's a nice sort of a callback when they go to that in Ragnarok. And the other thing that I enjoy about this film that kind of, you know, in terms of its legacy, is the way that, you know, this starts the sort of the peppering of the Marvel Universe, you know, where there's like things that are there in the background or things that are hinted at or mentioned offhand that if you're a huge Marvel geek like me, it's like catnip and you absolutely eat it up and you love it. But if you're not as well, it doesn't really matter, or it might encourage you to go away and go on a wee Google hunt to find out what they're talking about. Like there's one that's so seamless is when Selvig's talking about his friend who was like taken away by S.H.I.E.L.D. who's an expert in gamma radiation. I love that. I mean, that sort of stuff's brilliant. And obviously, your mileage on it depends on what you're looking for from these films, because I know some people think that they have leaned into it far too much, you know, and like everything has to be connected in some way, which is what makes things like maybe Moon Knight so refreshing, because, you know, it is very much its own thing, and, you know, that could be in any universe. It doesn't need to be an MCU, the way in which it's structured. But yeah, no, for me, the interconnectivity of it all is kind of what brings me back time and time again. It's what I love about it. It's what I loved about the comics as well, to be honest. And in terms of Thor himself, I think going forward, it'll be interesting to see if Hemsworth is going to be a long-term fixture in the MCU. Any interview you see with him, you get the impression that he's not done with the character, that he's not like in any hurry to leave. Obviously, Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans have kind of moved on to pastures new. Does feel that we'll see Evans again, I think, at some point down the road, but obviously I don't think we'll see Downey Jr. But I like the idea of Thor hanging around. I like the, even if he's not going to be in like a major character, I like the idea of him, even if Love and Thunder ends with Thor just being out there somewhere. That's what I want.
Yeah.
I don't want them to kill him off or to make some way that he won't be back. Just have it so that if we, you know, like 5 years from now, if we're building towards another Avengers or another Secret Wars or whatever the next thing is going to be, that, you know, we still have Chris Hemsworth's Thor on the board somewhere.
Yeah, just push him in a supporting role. Yeah, there's no reason they couldn't.
Yeah. Because I'm a huge fan of what he does going forward. I think he doesn't quite hit it out the park in this go round. But again, I think that's because the film doesn't really know what it wants to do with Thor fully yet either. And it really isn't until the Russo brothers and arguably Taika Waititi get their hands on the character. Taika obviously does something drastically different, where it's not so much a character arc as a character spike, where he becomes something quite new. And then the Russos really add, I think they add a magnificent amount of depth to him in Infinity War and Endgame. I love what they've done with the character. And so, yeah, like I say, he's one of the original Avengers, and I really hope that going forward, he's still going to be in the MCU somewhere.
I'd forgotten about, or sort of glossed over the line about the friend who was an expert in gamma radiation. It's, why didn't we get a Selvig Banner interaction in the Avengers?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, wouldn't that be great? Like, if you're gonna go down that road, why not bring yourself back?
I mean, they were both there.
Hulk him somewhere.
They could have had a chat.
I didn't even think about that at all. You're right. They are both in the Avengers movie, aren't they? They could have had something.
Yeah, absolutely. They can still do it though. There's still time. Both actors around.
Absolutely. It doesn't look like Marvel are going to be running out of screen time anytime soon. So if they're, you know, if they're looking for things to do, that's certainly a pairing that I'd be really keen to see.
Yeah, and then the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff is obviously one big MCU reference. That's the through line at this point, isn't it? S.H.I.E.L.D. / Nick Fury. I do wonder if they tried to get Samuel L. Jackson to do the Coulson stuff, and then he wasn't up for it, so it's, we'll get Clark Gregg, he's cheap, he's fine.
I read an interview with Samuel L. Jackson, and he was asked, like, are you going to be in the Thor movie? This is obviously going back to before the release. He was asked, are you going to be in the Thor movie? And he said, well, they told me I was going to be in the Thor movie, but I don't actually know if I'm going to be in the Thor movie. I'm waiting for somebody to phone me and tell me. And I think that sums up a lot of this sort of early Marvel, where it's like, well...
Yeah, and then he is, but he isn't.
Yeah, exactly. They shoehorn him into the post-credit again at the end with Selvig and Loki.
Yeah. Have you read the comic Fury's Big Week, or Busy Week, or whatever it's called?
No.
It's set in amongst, because Iron Man 2, Thor... and the present-day side of Captain America are all happening at the same time.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's basically a story of Nick Fury just trying to spin all these plates and figure out what's going on, because you joke about in, say, the Star Wars universe, Han Solo had a really busy week where everything that defines him happened, but in this it is actually, this is all happening at the same time. Oh, Incredible Hulk's happening at the same time as well. So he's managing those three things. And the What If episode that is set around this time is a loose adaptation of that comic in a way, in terms of its setup, as in all this is happening and we need to figure out what's going on. Fury's Big Week or Busy Week, I'm not sure which one it is, but you'll find it easily enough.
It is interesting. I mean, like you said there, that's one of the things about this film is it's happening concurrently with several other movies that are going on in the MCU. And I know Feige has mentioned a few times that he is planning to publish a Marvel timeline, but he's been saying that for about 2 or 3 years. So I would love to actually see it all written down, to see where they think everything fits. And obviously, I know there's the controversial moment in Spider-Man Homecoming that breaks the timeline by, doing the 8 years later thing at the very start of the film.
Yeah, I think that was just essentially a typo, wasn't it?
I hope so, yeah, because I remember that just like throwing the fandom into a meltdown. Like, how does any of it make sense? It's like, don't worry, it's fine. It's just one of those things.
We miscalculated, okay? The same way that Thor is on a tube line that doesn't exist in the next film. It's just,
we didn't
look into it too extensively.
It's like, that's one of my bugs, my pet hates, I'll be honest with you, is London-centric podcasts getting stuck up on the geography of London when it comes to these Marvel shows. They did it for Moon Knight and Thor as well. It's like, guys, no one cares. It's all right. It's fine. It's like we don't care what line goes where. But yeah.
But you're filming in London. You could have just asked someone, what station does he need to be at to get there in three stops?
That kind of pedantry is what keeps the fandom alive, though, isn't it? That's what we thrive on. So, Craig, any final thoughts, or if you think we've hit everything we need to hit here?
No, I think we've hit more or less everything. I'll just reiterate that it's near the bottom of the pile of the Marvel movies for me. I find the Earth stuff quite tedious for the most part, because I'm just waiting for stuff to happen. I do love what they're doing with Loki and Thor in this movie, especially Loki, I think. But even then, he's quite passive for quite a lot of it, just kind of sitting on his throne. Or you get the bit where
uh-huh.
I don't know if he's actually there or he's not there, is he? He definitely projects himself into the S.H.I.E.L.D. base.
I don't, maybe he is there, because he tries to lift the hammer on his way out, remember?
Coulson doesn't see anybody in the room with him, and it's because he says goodbye, and then Coulson says, but we've just started, or whatever it is. So you get that. The interrogation's actually quite good, actually, where Coulson's really smart, good at his job, and that's something that made him endearing to fans, because obviously he was in the two Iron Man films and then this, and I get the feeling he was supposed to be in Captain America, but maybe scheduling didn't allow it, because in the Avengers he mentions being there when Cap was thawed out, so it doesn't make sense that he's not there. It's just some randoms. So it's not him. So
yeah, you can totally imagine him being at the bedside, or being one of the guys to track him down the Times Square. Yeah.
Yeah. So Coulson, again, a great boost for him in this, and then obviously in the Avengers and then Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yeah. So it was really good getting Coulson to take a more central role in this film, actually, than he had been in the other films. It showed how popular he was getting. He'd done the shorts as well. There's the consultant and there's a funny thing happened on the way to Thor's hammer where he just stops a convenience store robbery.
Yeah.
Basically, that's what he does. But yeah, it's good character. So it's, I don't know, I think I've softened to this film over the years, but I still don't revisit it unless I'm doing a full MCU rewatch and it's part of the, you know, the completionist side of I'm just going to do these in order, which I haven't done in a while, but it's, yeah, it's fine, I suppose. It's just the central arc is Thor learning humility, and then I don't buy the fact that he becomes humble. It's just, I don't understand what changes in his life that makes him be more humble, other than the fact he's just kind of lost everything and kicked out and Loki's in charge and whatever.
Last time I did a sort of like personal ranking of the films, which is crikey, a while ago now. It's certainly before Phase 4 started, so I need to maybe go back and look at that. But anyway, the last time I did a sort of ranking of these, Thor was very much sort of like lower mid-table for me. You know, it's not a bad film by any stretch of the imagination. And given it comes so early in the MCU's run, I think it shows a lot of really interesting visual things and, you know, hints at what's coming later and establishes Tom Hiddleston as like, early on, is the MCU's MVP. You know, like he's, you know, he can do so much, so likable, booable, hissable, yeah. all at once. You know, he's got a lot going for him. I really enjoy Hiddleston, but I do think that it suffers from a lot of problems we've covered here, you know, at length. So yeah, it's not top tier Marvel. I think of Phase One, it's probably. It's above Incredible Hulk because, of course, it is.
I like Incredible Hulk. I'll be appearing on this podcast to talk about Incredible Hulk at some point.
I think it's probably above Iron Man 2 as well. Iron Man 2 does fall into that pitfall of trying to be too interconnected. You know, everything feels like it's a reference to something. So, yeah, of the Phase 1 movies, it's probably in my bottom three, but top of the bottom three. And, yeah, it's very enjoyable. Really happy to have revisited it for the podcast. Because it's the first time I've seen it. Similarly to you, Craig, since I last did a big Marvel rewatch with my kids, actually. So, yeah, it was nice to watch after a few years and kind of couldn't remember all the plot beats, and it was nice to see that it still stands up pretty well. So, yeah, I think that's all we've got time for this week on Podcast 616. So all that remains is for me to thank my guest, Craig McKenzie, for coming along. Craig, can you let the listeners know where they can find you and more of your work online?
Sure thing. I can be mostly found on Neil Before Blog, so that's neilbeforeblog.co.uk, or if you type it into Facebook and Twitter, it will come up there. I do a lot of reviews of nerdy stuff. So at the moment that we're talking, I'm reviewing Ms. Marvel, Superman and Lois, The Flash. Still watching that. Someone has to. I'm still doing it. Reviewing The Boys, do film reviews as well. There's an attached podcast where we did, most recently, a news roundup, which we do once a month. And coming up will be the Doctor Strange episode whenever time lets me edit it. And there's talk about Picard season 2 and things like that. So there's all that there. And when you talked about Marvel ranking, I did do an update to a Marvel ranking before Endgame came out. So that's something you could read. It's on the website. Type in Marvel ranking in the search field and it's there to be consumed. You'll see this film near the bottom of it, but not at the bottom of it. I won't say what my bottom film is, but it's there. So there you can do that. On We Made This, at the moment, I'm co-hosting with Ashley and Tony, we are Starfleet, to talk about Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which is another thing I review in Neil Before Blog, actually. So that's on there too. And I crop up on Podcast 616 quite a lot. I crop up on Real Talk because I see the films opening weekend, and Dan always has a almost guaranteed guest in me when I see the big films opening weekend. No one else does. So there's there and all sorts of other places. So you can find me there. And as for now, my contractual obligation, my personal Twitter handle is Nemesis4909, which started life as a Resident Evil reference and then later became also a Star Trek reference. So two of my favourite things aligned, and I didn't even know it at the time. Well, I didn't have Twitter at the time. It was an old playing Star Trek Armada and Red Alert 2 online handle back in the dial-up days. So there we go. That's me. That's where you can find me.
Busy, busy boy, Craig. I'm quite interested to hear your thoughts on Picard Season 2, actually. I'll need to dig that out because I only just finished that this week. I kind of waited and waited and waited, just never got around to it and kind of binged it all over maybe 4 or 5 days. And I have thoughts. I have thoughts. It'd be interesting to hear what you think of it. So you can find me on Twitter at AngrySkotsman81, where I kind of ramble about all things Marvel and horror. And you can find links to my horror fiction and my critical work at the London Horror Society there. I'm also currently working on an upcoming podcast called Vampire Videos, which I will be co-hosting along with Dan Owen. Where effectively we're going to be covering 100 years of vampire cinema. We've got some great guests lined up and some brilliant films to talk about, so I'd encourage you all to keep an eye out for that when it launches in August, I believe we're aiming for. But keep an eye on my socials.
I want to be in the Underworld episodes of those, that show.
I will note you down. I will note you down because I need someone who's going to show some enthusiasm for those films, so that'll be good. and remember, Podcast 616 is part of the We Made This Podcast Network, so stay tuned for previews of more shows there you may like to subscribe to in just a moment. Costing Marvel Studios an estimated $150 million, Thor would go on to gross nearly $449 million worldwide. Along with the success of both the Iron Man films and the Incredible Hulk before it, the Marvel juggernaut was beginning to pick up speed as it careered towards Thor's next big screen appearance in 2012's The Avengers. Audiences wouldn't have to wait too long, though, for a Thor-led sequel, with Alan Taylor's Thor: The Dark World hitting cinemas 2 short years after this film. That film would prove to be far more divisive and a difficult production, however, and you can hear all about that one on next week's episode of Podcast 616. Until next time, bye for now.
Elsewhere on We Made This. We dig music.
This is evidence enough that I was kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Particularly because your initial choice was from 1986.
It was on a 1978 playlist. People yeah. that do year-based playlists need to calm the fuck down and check their facts. I mean, granted, I am a person that's done a year-based playlist and I need to calm down and check my fucking facts, which is fine, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
But, like...
Or you can just do what I do and like just say, no, it's a compilation album that's released in that year and I'm definitely going to do it.
I can't do that because Chris Rea has a time machine. He released a compilation of his mid-80s tracks.
But you know,
earlier.
The weird thing is, so yeah, we switched this one out quite late on in our preparation for the
last
podcast,
night.
And it made fuck all difference to any of our notes.
A Dream Given Form, a Babylon 5 podcast.
On a science fiction heavy TV series, I'm not sure how much he can push the boundaries that way. So I think it has to be in terms of storytelling,
yeah,
and character, in progressiveness, I think. And kind of looking back at Sensei, I think that's a good way of going forward.
So what are your thoughts kind of around the idea of the CW network being a network to pick up the Babylon 5 reboot?
I don't know whether it's the right one or not, in all honesty. And with the recent kind of announcement that CW's being sold,
yeah,
which is why... the pilot script's not been picked up.
Frame to frame.
The overarching narrative of Nolan's trilogy is so good. Nolan dedicated an entire movie to us understanding Bruce Wayne and why Bruce Wayne wants to become the embodiment of fear. That groundwork is what then allows the Dark Knight to become the incredibly tortured, bleak, like almost nihilistic beast that it is, in which there's no such thing as a hero. There are no heroes.
No, exactly. But as a question to you, are you suggesting then, if a film hypothetically was to exist without giving us the Batman Begin portion, but to exist in, I don't know, the second or third year of the Batman story, that is dark, bleak and nihilistic, if it was not to have the Batman Begins, do you think it wouldn't quite work as well as The Dark Knight?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This Podcast Network.